Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Alfred Muhammad II, filling in for my father, Imam Alfred. I'm currently trying to get into the studio right now where I will introduce Imam Yusuf Salam if he is in the studio, which hopefully it is, he is. But my father will be in soon. He had to attend to some other matters, but he will be in soon. And Imam Yusuf Salam will introduce him, and the same old tandem will work today here on Religion Means Alive. But I just have to log into the studio, and then we can really begin the show. Oh, hold on for 1 second. All right. Oh, man. Currently logging into Blog Talk right now. All right. I don't know what's going on. I believe we're encountering a couple of technical difficulties, so just bear with us for right now. Hold on for 1 second. All right. Looks like we are now making some progress. Now logging in. Hold on. Okay. Logging in. I'm now logging to the studio, and I see Imam Yusuf Salam in the queue. He's waited patiently with us. Sorry for the delay time for 4 minutes for not being able to get on the air, but now I'm able to put him on. Imam Yusuf Salam, are you there?
Yes. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. I apologize. There's a problem with my computer I was working on, but whenever you're ready. My father will be here in a couple of minutes, so you don't have to worry about it.
Let me say this. I talked to your father extensively for about 35 minutes to maybe possibly 45 minutes today. And we understood that, without a doubt, the format would be interview style. I indicated to him that I had just been involved in some activity last night talking, and I had Juma today. So, but you did a pretty good job. Last time we were together with the interview format, and I see no reason why you can't do it now, especially with all these very vital and galvanizing events that's happening in the country and in the world. So, by the way, congratulations on your selection to great Bounty and Awards at Morehouse College, and I pray for your success.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, welcome. So, in that case, we
got to do an interview. All right.
And then when he arrives, he can make the transition smoothly and take over. If he doesn't arrive within the hour, we will just continue our dialogue.
Okay. Well, actually, I it's funny, something just popped into my head. I was going to ask you, what did you think of Mr. Trump's speech that he gave yesterday? It was one of the longest speeches, if I'm not mistaken, in like any convention history, like any nominee's history. What did you think about it? I'm sure, I mean, many people.
Not only was it the longest, it's the most un-American, non-democratic political presentation that I've heard in my life cycle, having been a student of government, a legislative person, a governmental operative. It's horn book understanding, everyday understanding, cardinal principle that we have three branches of government, the legislative branch and the judicial branch and the executive branch. And those branches operate as a counterpoint and counterbalance system. Inherent wisdom on the part of the founding fathers. And for a political candidate in America to say that I can do everything, all you have to do is depend upon me, is one of the most tragic statements in the history of our political discourse. Why? What do you mean by that? You may have to appoint an empty seat on the judiciary. Are you going to command and demand that the selectee cater to every position that you want? If you do something unconstitutional, you already have an agreement with this justice that it's got to go your way because you're going to do it all. Made the Speaker of the House blink. Paul Ryan, the Honorable Paul Ryan, when you only a nominee for the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. What are you going to do when you have the powers of the presidency? Are you going to turn Senator Mitch McConnell, and Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan into your servile puppies so you can do it all and America would depend upon you as a savior? That was an absolute disaster of a presentation for people who understand what America supposed to be about governmentally and politically, as well as constitutionally.
I was watching the CNN commentating that occurred afterwards, and I think it was Anna Navarro. Anna Navarro was talking about Mr. Trump's speech, and she's a Republican. She's a hardcore conservative, and she was supporting the former governor out of Florida, Jeb Bush, and she said that it was the most un-American speech that she's ever heard in her life. Both out of both parts, she said it was terrible, and she said if you thought that that was American, she said you have a serious problem. So now this is coming from a Republican, a serious conservative, someone who supported Jeb Bush and has been rocking with the Bushes heavy, you know, probably for as long as she's been covering politics and has been rocking with conservatives heavy as long as she's been covering politics. And even she had to confess and say, well, that was absolutely terrible. And, you know, personally, I think it wasn't a very great speech. I don't know what I suspect that this rise of Donald Trump really is nothing but just an allergic reaction to the president.
If you look at what happened yesterday, Roger Ailes, the super sorcerer behind not only contemporary American media, but also the shaper and former of contemporary politics in America, especially so-called conservative Republican politics. He and this other Roger Stone, both worked for Richard Nixon. And Roger Stone has been a self-confessed perpetuator of what he calls the Nixonian flame. Now, he is not an allergic reaction. There are some powerful forces behind Trump that has been working on a plan ever since Richard Nixon was elected in 1968. They have been methodical. They have been systematic. They have been determined. They have been resolute to take their time into spring the culmination of their plan through Donald Trump in this day and time. Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, Roger Ailes, and Roger Stone. I don't know whether your audience or yourself is familiar with Roger Stone.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Okay. Yeah. They go way back. They go all the way back to Richard Nixon in 1968. Secondly, there are forces that are allegedly not working with Trump, but they are working with Trump. For instance, Charles and David Koch, they have thrown out a dissembling projection that they're not with Trump. But they were with Scott Walker. And Scott Walker wholeheartedly backed Trump during this convention. He's in the Koch brothers' pocket. He would not He would not have done that without their tacit approval. So we shouldn't be naive and think that Trump is a political lone wolf. No, there are powerful American forces. And President Obama, Secretary Clinton, former President Clinton, they understand what they're up against if they're going to beat these forces back. I'm kind of worried about the fact whether the average American who is against Trump is going to wave him off as some kind of lightweight phenomenon and get caught with their political and governmental pants down and not really exert effort to try to stop this very, very serious threat to American democracy. Very serious threat. It's not a light threat.
Yeah, because there are many who on both sides. I mean, I've noticed it you could tell it's an all out, you know, rebellion within the Republican Party, because you have Republicans who have shown up for years at these conventions. You know, you got the Bushes. I know here in Jersey, the former governor of New Jersey, King, it's a college here called King University, and his family donated the land for King University, and his family is very wealthy. They were Republican. You know, he was a Republican governor. He did not show up. You got people like Christy Todd Whitman, who probably aren't even going to vote. She was also the governor of New Jersey. You got people like her who probably aren't going to vote. So you have an all-out, you know, just rebellion going on in that party. And it makes me wonder what's going to happen to the Republican Party, you know, after this. Will heads roll, you know, for the people who support Trump if they lose? Will it just dissolve entirely? I'm kind of confused as to the direction it's going to go. But either way, it's not looking good because the party could be damaged severely. I don't know if you agree or not.
Yeah, I would agree. But what you're dealing with is that, in my opinion, I discussed this matter with a person this morning that's been looking at this. Up until 1964, the New England Anglo-Saxon Protestant moderate arm of the Republican Party was the dominant force. New York Republicans, Javis,
Nelson, Rockefeller,
all those folk. With the rise of Barry Goldwater, the center began to shift out west. First of all, you had him, then you had Nixon, and then you had President Ronald Reagan. What happened was the Eastern establishment, in my opinion, saw an extreme form of republicanism developing in Texas. And we can still see this kind of extreme form of republicanism. Really, it goes all the way back to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In my opinion, George H.W. Bush, who was an intelligent operative, he went into Texas, moved from New England, and tried to bring this little moderate brand of republicanism back to the party, but through the guise of a Texas cowboy hat, cowboy outfit. And the Bushes, were successful to kind of grab that thing back a little bit. They had to throw out a few little conservative bones, but none of these forces, these Western forces, these Sun Belt forces, would have had the attitude that Bush had by standing up and holding Michelle Obama's hand at that recent event in Dallas. It was only so much that Bushes were going to do out into the Republican hinterland of box-like alien politics. They simply would only go so far. But with the rise of President Barack Hussein Obama, that put a lot of pressure on these forces that had been operating behind the scenes. Ailes and Manafort and all of them, they've been involved in all these campaigns since Nixon. And Obama's rise was unexpected. And so when he came in, they overreacted, creating the Tea Party, allowing the subsurface racism of their base, who never did vote for Obama. 59% voted against him in the Romney election. And then after the Tea Party in 2010, 2011, Roger Stone got together with Donald Trump, gave him the Bertha idea, and from that point on, he began to stoke and pour gasoline on the resentment of Obama, President Obama, in the Republican base. And the rest is history. This whole Trump campaign is a result of the mastermind of the Black Prince of the Republican Party. That's what Roger Stone calls himself. And he says he's a practitioner of the black arts. And he mastered dirty tricks on Richard Nixon. By the way, he has worked with the Libertarian Party and Gary Johnson. And he's noted.
Yo, you know something? Hold on one second. You know something? I figure it was something weird with that whole libertarian thing because you know, I realized that libertarian thing might be something to split the vote. I don't know why Gary Johnson's getting so much press or whatever, but something is going on where things are so divisive where it could split the vote. I don't know whose vote is going to split.
Tamara Hall brought up today, and this reinforced what my recent research have indicated. She said that the polls indicate she was telling a Never Trump person because she was saying she could not vote for Hillary Clinton. But the reporter pointed out, well, we just had a poll yesterday that says without the Libertarian Party, Hillary would beat Donald Trump. But with the Libertarian Party, the polls say she might lose. Granted, we're a long way out, but if the election was held today. So the lady was asked, well, if you want to stop Trump and you saying you're going to vote Libertarian, then you would be giving the presidency away. She said, well, maybe so. The election is 3 months away. I don't know whether those polls are going to hold up. But anyway, it's a lot of time, and I could change my mind. The point is, it's a historical fact that very recently, within the last 3 years, the black prince of the practitioner of black arts, black magic in the Republican Party has had a political relationship with former governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson. So now, in several races, study Stone's history. He has been good at putting candidates out to dilute the vote of the opposition. That's one of his magical formulas.
So then, if that's the case, then what was Romney then? I mean, you talk about, like, you know, how the Western establishment, well, not the Western establishment, but that base, that kind of subtly racist white supremacist base that was, you know, sort of hiding in the Republican Party that they kind of let loose, you know, in the past couple of years. If that's the case, then what incurred
Romney wouldn't play Trump. Romney wouldn't exploit it. His spiritual orientation, he could have exploited it too. You notice he's not supporting Trump. That's because he felt that these folks have gone too far in the sense of the means justifying the end, taking the presidency back, even at the expense of dividing Americans and laying a proto fascist type foundation in this country where the Constitution is put on the back burner. And when you say, I will do it, I will save you, that's a dictatorship. That's not a democracy.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit, it's pretty scary when you know, you're looking back at it. So Romney was really just the last of the really sane. I mean, of course, you know, I expect, you know, that you don't agree with, you know, Romney's policies regarding, you know, politics. But in a sense, Romney was probably the last of the, you know, real, you know, conservatives or Republicans with some sense, you know.
That's right. If you look at where he came from now, remember what I said about the New England East Coast Brahmins. Even though he was, his father was governor of Michigan, Romney was governor of Massachusetts. The heart of this Anglo-Saxon Brahmin type moderate Republican situation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he never did buy into that. Neither did George W. Bush, by the way, former President Bush, but Cheney and Rumsfeld, they go back to the days of Nixon. And they manipulated Bush a little bit and maneuvered him. And I think if we reflect and be objective, it's a lot of truth to the statement I just made.
Well, that's the reason why I think that's the reason. I think George H.W. Bush, you know, is you know, George W. Bush's father. He came out with an autobiography, I think, a year ago, and he talked about his disgust for. He talked about. Hello.
I'm listening. Yes.
Okay. And he talked about his disgust for I think, I don't know if it was Rumsfeld or it was Cheney, but he talked about how he really was not displeased with how they ran the administration and how they pretty much, you know, kind of, I don't know if they, I didn't read the book fully, but how he was, he just expressed how he really did not, you know, dig Cheney and Rumsfeld. So it's pretty interesting that, you know, they really didn't see eye to eye. And, you know, it also explains as well why Nelson Rockefeller was, I don't know, maybe it was also because he was other personal reasons, but it also probably explains why the Republican Party rejected him, Nelson Rockefeller, back in the day.
Well, they were changing. They went in transition, and a lot of it was he was a Democrat, but the Kennedys were from this, what they call New England Yankee-like power base. And Richard Nixon, the former President Nixon, he hated those folks because they rejected them. They looked down upon him because he was not in that grouping. It was not Barry Goldwater that won the presidency as a Republican after Kennedy and Johnson. It was President Nixon, and he's the key man in all of this situation. He had a super dog side, but unlike Trump, President Nixon was politically and governmentally brilliant. He was no dummy.
Richard Nixon was no dummy, yeah.
He was no dummy. He was legally trained, had been around, understood the political and systemic orders of American politics, and he knew exactly the weak points within the system.
Yeah, that's the reason why he was able to, get the, his movement going. In a sense, I believe he was a very skilled politician. I mean, he wrote a couple of books on the, the art of the comeback, and because for a minute he was, out regarding politics, and for someone to really get back in like that just shows the, his ability regarding politics. But I mean, the Republican Party is a mess, to say the least. Do you hope at least for the Republican Party to get itself together for the sake of the two-party system?
I hope for some party, if they lose this election and lose it big. There's been other instances in American history where major parties collapsed and other parties that became powerful emerged from their ashes. That's what happened with the party of Lincoln, same kind of process. So, in the long run, for the sake of American democracy, Quran says that everything is created in pairs. So, in creation, even in the realm of government, you need at least two parties to make a pair in order to have a functional government that exists in created reality. So yes, but I don't know if they implode, whether they can come back in the current form. I really don't know. That's a question mark that's hanging out there.
Yeah, definitely. So my father is now in the studio. Imam Alfred is, he came in now. So he will take over now. So Imam Alfred.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience, and peace to our beloved brother, Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. I would like to start the questions by asking, how can there be a functional coalition between African Americans who are conservative and Caucasian Americans who also are conservative on many of the, what we would, some would call the culture wars, and how can we form that beloved community minus the white supremacists and the black reaction to it?
Well, first of all, we got to truly define what is conservatism and what is alter ego conservatism. What do I mean by that? When I taught corporate law at Thurgood Marshall College of Law, one of the basic early concepts is that how do you determine what's a genuine corporation and what's a sham entity designed to get the benefits of corporate existence, but really not being a corporation in substance. So they came up with a concept where you have to pierce the corporate veil and actually see, well, this is not really a corporation. When you look behind the outward trappings, you really have something else. And what we see that has developed in America, what was really conservatism?
Excuse me, Mona, I think we lost the connection. I don't hear. Are you with us?
I hear you. I hear you. You can't hear me?
I heard Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam.
I hear you. You can't hear me?
Okay.
Do you hear me? I hear you.
Brother Imam?
Yes, I hear you. Do you hear me?
Stand by, dear people. We may be experiencing some technical difficulties. I cannot hear our brother. He's just developing a concept.
He's on.
Yeah, it's easy to find out. Let's get another phone and listen in. Brother Imam?
Yes, I hear you. Do you hear me? I hear you. Do you hear me?
I cannot hear him. Keep talking. No, we're testing now. Dial in for the people to listen. Dear beloved people, we're still experiencing some difficulty here. I'm trying to determine whether you can hear us or not. 805-727-7013. Press 1 if you can hear us. Brother Imam, can you hang up and call back in?
Certainly.
I don't think we are, the audience is hearing you.
Hold on, I'll call back.
Can you hear me? Okay. So, dear beloved people, we're trying to make our reconnection with our brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. If brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam is with us.
Brother Imam, if you're in, we're just experiencing some difficulties. I'm waiting for the technical assistant. We're going to call brother Imam and get a reconnection. Brother Imam, are you still with us? Great. Dear beloved people, just stay tuned. We're experiencing some technical difficulties. we were in the middle of our interview, and I don't know what has happened to us. Just a minute. So as soon as... We're still on the air, and I just want to invite everybody to come to the convention. While we're waiting, try to get connected to Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. I want to invite our audience to come to the Mosque Cares annual convention started by Imam Warif Deen Muhammad. I believe this is the 28th year of the Mosque Cares convention. Why should we fall off now that Imam Muhammad is physically not with us? It will be in Tenley Park Convention Center. It will open with Juma. The Juma Khatib will be Imam Alfred Muhammad. We will have workshops. We expect business people to be together, educators to be together, cultural people, a nice cultural night, Friday night live, cultural night. We are going to also have many workshops in every aspect of human life. So I would invite the entire audience to tell your friends, tell your families to spend Labor Day weekend together. God says to us in the Quran, wa'amanu wa'amanus salihat. Wa'amanu wa'amanus salihat. Believe, trust God. Doesn't just say believe in God, but trust God, be trustworthy, and trust one another. First of all, trust God. Trust the prophet. Trust one another. And do as Jesus the Christ has said, love you one another as I have loved you. That's what Imam Muhammad warned us to do. He warned us to love one another. That's what we need is a love campaign for the followers and supporters of Imam Warif Deen Muhammad, Warif Deen Muhammad, to come together as a solid wall to represent the message of Imam Muhammad. If the Republicans can come together with all kinds of factions and at least make an appearance, why can't you? What is your disagreement with Mosque Cares? Why aren't you there to show your face in the place? We're a national entity. Don't get mad when others define Al-Islam. Don't get mad when others define Africa. Don't get mad when others define America. This is a shared freedom space. So we want you all to be in the place to come to the convention, to be there. And if the Honorable Elijah Muhammad were living, is Imam Yusuf Salam is he on? Brother Imam, Brother Imam Yusuf Salam, is he on? We're waiting for Brother Imam Yusuf Salam to return, or we have something. Oh, I think he's on. I don't know what happened, but we're getting ready to come back. Alfred Y. Muhammad is going to man the board, and we will be like to share with you somewhat of a great and joyous fact.
Excuse me.
Is he on? Brother Imam?
Yes, I'm on. Are you?
Oh, good, good. You were explaining to us corporate law, and you had taken us to the law school there at Thurgood Marshall College of Law, and you were talking about piercing the corporate veil. So
that's right.
Talk about, is there room for a genuine conservative movement? And
the key, we have to be able to pierce the conservative alter ego and determine whether or not we're dealing with conservatism or sham conservatism. That's my point, because evidence is coming out slowly but surely that really the conservative movement post Barry Goldwater in this country with Richard Nixon onward may have been an alter ego shell that was claiming to be conservative with the rise of the mall majority movement. But when all that stripped away, these people last night were talking about a gay rights. And you know, we discussed that. I'm not going to bash that. But for them, that's a deep departure from their so-called conservative roots. The only thing that's left from that whole conservative movement is the intensification of the Southern strategy, which was adopted to circumvent African-American rights. But to answer your question, if a genuine conservative party actually emerge in America, I think we all can come together, because one of their strongest tenets is big government in the individual and small government in the nation. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had a bedrock conservative principle that we call do for self. But they gotta be conservative in reality, and not trying to maneuver and acquire power by using wedge issues to stimulate their base until that become weak. You got to go back to the basic reason for being, feeding them a bunch of racial red meat, which is what we see with Donald Trump.
I you brought to mind Jerry Falwell, which I happen to have grown up in the same hometown. I don't say he grew up in my at the hometown, because I recall Jerry Falwell very vividly being a white supremacist. I don't use racist. He was a white supremacist. And most of what I remember, the old Dixiecrats were white supremacists. They wanted to serve.
Oh, yes, that's right.
When I was speaking beyond the political scope, I'm speaking of decent Caucasian American. I wasn't even speaking politically. I'm speaking of Mormons. I'm speaking of Orthodox Jews and others whose views socially is akin to ours. And I'm not here to bash anybody, but I do know those values, how we peel away. I don't want to get beyond the political, because I'm a religious person. And I want to talk about how there can be a coalition of decent religious people, minus the white supremacists.
We have to build it upon what we common terms.
Right,
what's common terms? We all believe
equality of man, the respect for all religious pluralism. That's what I'm talking about.
And the inherent decency of the sons and daughters of Adam.
That's what I'm talking about.
Respecting each other, willing to embrace each other. Yes.
And value systems might diverge from, I think that many of the, we watched the Republican Party because I'm a hypertensive person. I haven't watched a lot of these programs. I appreciate people like yourself watching this, because I think everybody, some people feel some praying songs to watch. And I'm not temperamentally suited to watch white supremacists having survived Lynchburg, Virginia. And not coded. I'm not interested in dog whistles. What I'm interested in is defeating the scheme of Satan. Because I do know, I've met with some of these people. Not the people who are feeding red meat, because I had a conversation through another person with one of the big red meat people in this country. And he said, we got to gin up the base. Well, I'm not for ginning up my base. I'm not for ginning up any base. I'm for bringing enlightenment to all people. I think
you see some movement. There's a very interesting article out there on the internet where this Caucasian minister, very well credentialed, he's sort of like a pioneer rocket, threw the idea out in the atmosphere, and he was telling. In his article, he was explaining that it's time for the West to acknowledge Prophet Muhammad as a legitimate prophet. And then he goes on to lunch and to all the rationale of the late Ahmed Didat. Now, we know Brother Didat, what arguments he made to establish Prophet Muhammad as a prophet. This guy ran through the gamut. So already we see a movement afoot in all this political confusion in my mind, a deliberate, systematic attempt to lay the foundation for future dialogue along the lines that you're talking about.
Yes, and I have been in a dialogue with decent, well-meaning, I mean, even the President Carter wing and even wings of the people who still believe John 3:16 and John 1:14. I've had dialogue with them, and I say, isn't it a fact? I know I've dialogued with Christians. My mama was and probably in heaven still a Christian, and I call to mind that there are others in my family, Christians. We have great relationships. We agree to disagree. You believe that they believe that they believe in the itinerancy of Scripture, and I don't have any problem with people like that. We do have to share this land, and we should have a lot in common. I'm not about to be a Mormon. I'm not about to be an Orthodox Jew, but I inherently will fight for the rights of those people to propagate Baal religion and to even be protected in Muslim land. That's been the basis of my dialogue with them.
They talking about, and I'm going to bring this up from the world of politics, that's for the first time Utah could possibly go blue, because many Mormons out there are allegedly upset about the fact that Trump is threatening Muslims in some kind of way, in their mind. And they remember what happened to them historically in this country. And their
Could you share with our audience what happened to them and how they ended up in Utah from their place in upstate New York? I think the audience needs to know this.
They had forced to migrate, harassed, persecuted, all the way over into Ohio, and I think something went down and the persecution intensified, and their leader, Joseph Smith, I think, and some of his family members were actually murdered.
They were driven out of Zion, Illinois, and they had to go walk all the way across the west to Utah.
That's right. But all that happened in the Midwest, even though the group was founded in the eastern part of the United States.
Right.
And so that's how they end up now so numerous in Utah, because they had to, at great sacrifice, leave the Midwest and go to an area where they could worship relatively freely. And so they have strong feelings about religious persecution. And we can come to common terms with them, I think.
Yes, I think so. I've already had dialogues with them. And, you know, I know they believe, they're very adamant that they have the right belief. We're adamant that people have the right to choose. And like I tell my Christian friends, open the doors of the church, continue to keep them open. I'm not going to go in them. But I respect your right to do that. I respect your right to propagate or have churches in your and even lands where we're predominant, because I know that the prophet permitted that. So I think that there's a basis. We open the dialogue up. Yes, pluralism. And some Muslims get angry, as some Jews get angry when Christians evangelize them. But they're an evangelical religion. That's what makes us have in common. We both are interested in spreading our religion. So we are competitors for spreading our religion. But we are not going to bash each other. That's the basis for dialogue. And I think that the common rank-and-file member is ready for that. I don't know how many, besides this preacher you announced, told us about, are ready to pull away. I think you cited the case of your son meeting a pharmacist. And without going into details, there are people like that that I believe if we make a statement,
sorry for being making a big persuasive argument for the convention, but I think it's time for the Muslim, from Imam Muhammad's community, to stand up. And one of the highest political figures in the land, I won't name what office this person holds, and it may or may not be the President of the United States, but he did send a representative to the delegation of Muslims from Imam Muhammad's community and say, it's time for you all to stand up. I think we've done a poor job. So I'm going to shut up, and you got a lot to chew on, a big, great big jumbo steak. We celebrate my birthday before it happens, which is on the 25th, so if you could just tie that together and give us some comment. I'll give you a lot
but
to
all
eat
I,
on.
All I can say is that there's no need to revel in redundancy. You said it well, and I hear and not only agree, but I'm willing to obey in terms of activating those sentiments. So that's a fact. Now, as Muslims, we can walk and chew chewing gum at the same time. We can be concerned with matters of Mecca and trying to bring all the cubes together on the planet. That's where Adam is symbolized, right there at the Kaaba. We can bring them together with common terms in terms of a coalition. I agree. But at the same time, it's important that we keep Medina relatively strong. That's a loose phraseology referring to not technical Medina, but the idea of enlightened government on this planet. Because we want a scenario where people of faith can express themselves freely under the First Amendment so that these coalitions can be built. And we don't want a darkened government where that kind of dialogue is restricted by clamping down on First Amendment religion. So that's important as well.
Let's now turn our attention to the horrific killings by law enforcement, and I would say equal horrific reaction to this. Would you care to comment on that?
No doubt about it. In both cases, it's bad. But we do have a problem. And it's not just about killing. It's a mindset behind the killing. During the Republican Party, the media squashed an incident because they understood Candidate Trump's political strategies, and they didn't want to rain on his parade. But during this convention in Miami, Florida, an African-American social worker ran in the streets to try to retrieve an autistic child, looked like he was Caucasian, and bring him back to the facility. In the meantime, law enforcement showed up, and he laid on his back, the African-American did, and threw his hands up. One of the cops pulled his gun, and the African-American asked him, "What are you about to shoot for? I'm out here trying to save this autistic child." Pat on his back, hands in the air, and the cop shot him anyway. Fortunately, he did not die. He shot him 3 times. He could have died. So even though there was no killing, the mindset to kill was there. I mean, that's completely a non-pan, dragon, draw-showing situation. A professional man outgoing beyond the call of duty then has to later remember these other incidents, lays on his back, throw his hands up, talk to the cop. Now, according to the report I heard, the guy asked, well, why did you shoot me? And the response was, I don't know. Now, today, one of the people brought it out a little bit, now that the convention is over, and they claim the cop said he accidentally shot. But on the day of the shoot, he said he didn't know why he had shot the guy.
How do we change public opinion where those kinds of illegal acts, and you have also been a criminal defense attorney and a prosecutor, but you put your prosecutorial hat on, and I don't want you to focus on this incident. I just think that we have had just a free reign. I mean, in ordinary circumstances, we're not law enforcement. It seems to me that would be manslaughter at least, and perhaps second-degree murder at worst.
Well, that attempt, that what I just gave you could have been a real charge of attempted murder if it was not for law enforcement, what I just gave you.
That's what I'm saying. If there were all there two citizens, wouldn't that be an attempt murder? You wouldn't have any difficulty with a grand jury indicting and perhaps a petty jury convicting such a person.
No, no, other charges, other lesser charges, but say an attempted murder.
Right, yes.
But now,
and it seems to me Minneapolis becomes, well, let's litigate one of them at a time, but I mean, this is, well, you know, it reminds me of Mayor Daley. You may not be old enough to remember him, but he had an order to the police of Chicago to shoot to kill. So it seems to me that there's somewhere along the line, consciously or subconsciously, police officers, some have mental orders to shoot to kill African American males. Am I imagining things?
Let me just tell you this. These latest killings, you don't have a lot of facts in which a defense attorney can hang a hat on. Now, in the early killings, Michael Brown and even Eric Garner, there was a little, even though a fair prosecutor could have dealt with Garner, I think that was clear. But there was a little obscurity in the facts still, not much. But these other cases that's happening lately are blatant. We have to ask the question, in the young African Americans, that doing these killings, they've been sitting back looking at a political situation where it looked like a person that's against their interest rising. I don't have to tell you the kind of language black folk use when they see a so-called white person rising that might hurt them. Then when you combine them sitting back and being aggravated, whether justifiable or not, in these blatant killings, if they're mentally unstable and crazy, they'll do something vicious and barbaric. At the same token, on the same token, let's be real. How many law enforcement people are thinking, my day coming, my man is rising? And this little excitement about a possible rise makes the trigger finger itch a little more. And they end up pulling that trigger in that kind of political expectation context. We got to understand that. Give another example. In the world of military and paramilitary, you must respect your commander in chief. Some guys will psychologically brag the commander in chief in the sense of giving superficial support because they don't like him. That may be one of the reasons. while there have been so many security lapses around President Barack Hussein Obama. Then we had a situation at a Trump rally where a Caucasian journalist got on out of line, and these Secret Service officers, some of them who have been so lackadaisical in their paramilitary status under President Obama, again, viciously, some might say even overzealously, bent on this reporter that they thought got out of line. Why did they have such enforcement zeal at a rally of a man who was not even president? So a lot of this nutty buddyism, both in the killers and in the wrongful behavior cops, in my opinion, is being fueled a little bit by a toxic political atmosphere. That's why these latest killings, in my opinion, been so blatant. The one in Baton Rouge, the one in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and this one in Miami, where this guy shot a guy, not with his pants dragging, not selling no CDs, not thugging, but a professional man doing his job, laying on his back with his hands in the air.
Reverend, ma'am, what do you make of the fact that Mr. Murdoch of the News Corporation is showing Roger Ailes the door?
Well, I really, to be honest, and I hear my son talking all the time about all these conspiracy theories on the internet about this or that. Even our Minister Louis Farrakhan, been a guest on this fella, Roger Stone, buddy, Roger Stone, the mastermind behind the Trump campaign, Alex Jones, this master conspiracy theorist. So I don't believe following a conspiracy theory behind every rat hole, okay, or every rabbit hole. But it's something about this outward story with Roger Ailes that I'm not buying. I'm detecting an element here that maybe doesn't pass the smell test. Why? How is it that this man who started his career, all you got to do is go Google it, in Cleveland, Ohio, and Philadelphia? This is a fact. It's clear. You can easily find it out. And the Republican convention is in Cleveland, and the Democratic convention in Cleveland. And so coincidentally and haphazardly and randomly, his career comes to an end when the cities where he's spotlighted, where he started his career, are being spotlighted in our national politics. Could it be a mere random coincidence, or it could be that there's a message in terms of timing? What I will say, and I know you started off with a very important question in terms of how we're to come together religiously, and I love that, and I certainly agree with that focus, and hopefully we move out in that direction. And I don't want to saturate the program with too much politics. But the truth of the matter is that Roger Ailes and Roger Stone, the mastermind behind Donald Trump's candidacy. They're joined at the hips all the way back to Richard Milhouse Nixon, former President Nixon. Also, Paul Manafort has been a political partner with Roger Stone for years. All three were involved in those ads coming out round about the time of Willie Hart. Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, to a lesser degree, Lee Atwater, and Roger Ailes. So now, I don't know whether this is a legitimate departure in that sense, or having seen the man who is a beneficiary of a strategy that goes all the way back to the Richard Nixon days of Faction America, taking advantage of the vision to produce a President Donald Trump, according to what I heard a journalist say, is the prime beneficiary of Roger Ailes and Roger Stone four-decade labor. So is he really leaving because of that? Of course, leaving with a pocket full of money. Or is he really leaving because he's 76 years old and he has worked a masterpiece in America, so he's going home?
Good question, as they would say in the Nation of Islam. I wonder, too. Or has he, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's, Mr. Murdoch is known as, he's not usually given to throwing people to the wolves in the midst of ongoing traffic. But
well, that's what I understand. And so there may be an element or intrigue here. The women, they're getting their fair share. He walking away with a sweet deal. And Fox, according to all the journalistic predictions, is going to continue to roll along. And if you take this step a step further, in the background now, is he free to go back to his political operative status, which he started off so brilliantly with Richard Nixon, was the main man who showed him how to use television after Nixon lost the television race in 1960 with John F. Kennedy. It was Roger Ailes who gave him the science as to how to use television. Is he stepping aside now from Fox? Does he have some kind of surreptitious plan to go and work behind the scenes and focus full time on getting this man home? We never know with these things, my brother.
Yes, this intrigues me greatly, and I hope we can follow this one up because I am very interested in Roger Ailes. He seems to been doing a lot of help. Him and Mr. Roger Stone. I don't know.
That's right.
We met him.
That's right.
Passing. I got two more questions. One of them is the Republican Party preparing now for an implosion? And is that the reason that John Kasich didn't show up anywhere and Mr. Cruz came and gave a 2020 campaign speech and was even turned away from the suite of Allison from Nevada? It seems that Ted Cruz got a very cold reception. What do you make of that, that the governor of the state of Ohio refused to come to the convention, but been holding press conferences, and Mr. Cruz came and gave a campaign speech, and Speaker Gingrich had to come behind and do a cleanup job? Is, in fact, the Republican Party in a mess and way over his head in problems, or is this all a charade?
Well, I think if you really look at it, let's go back to Texas. The rise of, and I said this earlier with your son, the Sun Belt from California to Texas Republican, Arizona, John McCain, and Barry Goldwater, superseding the dominant Northeast, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, stronghold of moderate republicanism that's ran the show up until the time of Barry Goldwater. Then we have Richard Nixon going into Texas, allegedly rebutting E.L. Hart. But the bottom line is that Texas become deep Republican country. Beforehand, it was Democratic country. Richard Nixon achieved the presidency, okay? And then we have a situation where George H.W. Bush Sr. moves into, as I said earlier, leaves New England, an operative on the level of high intelligence, a member of the CIA, adorning the garb of Sunbelt Republicanism, but in reality still a moderate Eastern Republican, trying to wrestle the crown back. And they kept it in their family. But Roger Stone calls himself, according to his quote, that he's been a keeper of the Nixonian plane. And now in order to preserve that plane and eliminate that old moderate influence for good, they got the party on the verge of an implosion. And if Donald Trump doesn't prevail, it's a big gamble. Another party may have to arise out of the ashes, the same way that Lincoln Republicanism arose out of the ashes from a previous power party. That's my take on it.
To now turn our attention to a very painful situation with Judge Williams' decision. You have served in the capacity as a prosecutor, and I feel a lot of sympathy for the mayor, the state's attorney there in the county of Baltimore, and Judge Williams, who is an African-American jurist, former U.S. Justice Department prosecutor. Is there any, what's wrong in the Freddie Gray case?
I think at this point now, I think it's enough evidence to raise a rebuttable presumption that the young prosecutor cases are unraveling. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the initial impulse was somehow shaken. That could be it, or it could be that the forces of the political union are more substantial. They remain firm in the little temporary emotional forces that put strength behind her initially have collapsed, and she's out there on a limb on her own now.
I'm curious about Judge Williams. I don't know if you have checked the judge's background out, but he is an African-American jurist, a former United States government prosecutor. And my initial impressions of him, that he's a very careful jurist, not a showman.
I don't know enough about the brother, and I would not hazard speculation. But being even-handed, judges are subject to the political process either for good or ill. I'll give you an example. Judge Curiel, the judge of Mexican extract that Donald Trump tried to pistol whoop. It's no accident that it's breaking news today that he ruled that the case against Trump in terms of Trump Institute can go forward and that it can be pursued vigorously. That may be an objective legal opinion, but it has dire political consequences for Donald Trump. Because believe me, now that this case is actually going to be litigated during the height of this campaign, it can be used to bludgeon him on this alleged strong point that he knows what's good for business and for the average American worker. Now, is it just a coincidence that this decision came out today, a day after this man had his coronation last night in Cleveland, or is there a nexus? So I repeat, it's hard when things get political to try to exempt jurors from being completely above the fray. Now, I'm going to leave that alone.
Well, I, much as I appreciate the law, I'm going to leave it along with you, and I will say this. I mean, judges are human beings, and they do have feelings. And,
let me say this about your governor. He's been very hard. Now, audience, I'm engaging in somewhat of a speculation. At a critical time during the President Obama re-election drive, Hurricane Sandy went down and Governor Christie took some political chances, embraced the president, hugged him. The photograph went all around the country, made it look like President Obama really could work with open Republicans and that he had been victimized by now Republicans, saboteur, so let's re-elect the man. Now, Prosecutor Paul J. Fishman, I think he's in charge.
Yes, sir.
Previous connections with Governor Christie. But you have President Obama, you have his attorney generals. A man did something that really benefits you in a big way. Now, I'm not saying that this is happening. Am I going to turn the dog loose on him when he get caught with his pants down? Am I really going to, Republican, am I really going to try to jam him? And I don't know whether it's too late. But with him going to the extreme now, weighing out Hillary Clinton like he did, going to the extreme and that stuff, it wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats can get a political angle on him now that they wouldn't try to do something to him legally before this election is over.
Well,
I'm not saying
they have good grounds, and one suspects that even Mr. Trump's son-in-law may have an interest in seeing the governor. Unfortunately, he's my governor, and I received an invitation from him to be in a meeting with him. And I'm like an old Southerner. You know, when you ask a Southern politician to be endorsing someone, he said, well, I'm going fishing. I heard the bass is catching that day. So that day, I happened to have been somewhere else that day anyway. So the governor's scheduled.
I don't understand, Governor Christie. With his flank so exposed, unless he knows something I don't know, it's a way to kind of support Trump without getting head over heels and that. I'm wondering now whether he feels that his political future is so uncertain that he got to play a gamble card to hope that he might be appointed to something in the Trump administration. And that's why he's doing this. I don't know.
He is. But I also think that Mr. Christie, is the governor Christie, is grabbing at straws. There's a plea of guilty on one of his top people. Mr. Sampson has pled guilty.
Yes, sir, that's right. I'm aware. You're right.
There's another trial coming up, and I believe there's an African-American judge, Judge Walls, if I'm not mistaken, that he may be facing. Now, I know Judge Walls is the judge. Very tough jurist, very fair-minded man, but it's very tough. I think the governor, well, I don't know whether you followed the piece in the New York Times, wherein it, in fact, said the governor's had prosecuted President, I mean, Mr. Trump's son, the Kushner, Jared Kushner's dad. So
I'm aware of that.
In the Trump campaign on the part of Mr. Trump's son-in-law. But the second thing is that Mr. Trump has been trying to walk back a story that has appeared in the paper. He's been disrespected by Mr. Trump and told that he eats too much candy and even sent him to McDonald's to get him some burgers. So I think
and he allegedly told him to stay away from the Oreos.
That doesn't seem to me like a man that respects him. Now, you can't forget that Mr. Trump's sister sits on the Third Circuit. Judge Trump. She's a Third Circuit judge that the Trump case.
I'm aware of that fact, and that's a dynamic in all of this, in my opinion.
I don't think Mr. Trump is really in such high regards by the Trump campaign. I think the governor, I don't think he's in such great regards. If the New York Times article is partially right, it seems that Mr. Governor Christie is maybe on a political suicide mission.
He may be, and that's what happened when you get desperate, my brother.
I don't even think he was thinking. If he were thinking, he would not have taken this route because, I mean, it's just he misread the tea leaves. I think he's lost. I think there's something about him is almost suicidal. If I were him, I would watch Mr. Fishman. Mr. Fishman is a very skillful prosecutor, very slow, very methodical prosecutor. And somehow or another, it has leaked that he is an unindicted co-conspirator. They're still investigating. As you perhaps aware, his cell phones are missing. He said the law firm, Randy Mastro's law firm, actually said that they don't know where the custody of these cell phones. So I think Governor Christie, is still being investigated.
That's a hazardous situation for him to be in because this guy spoke and actually said that Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, should be executed. He's been investigated. On the heels of that, Governor Christie came behind. He didn't say that, but he threw a lot of gasoline on the fire. Look, some of those people, and I'm not going to call his name in the Democratic Party, can hit you with some hardball. Know how to play that power hardball. And he's vulnerable to a hard swing, if you ask me.
I would think so as well.
So, brother, ma'am, you kind of cut loose. You need a lot of politics. You need to stop.
It seems to me
stop playing possum with your brother. You know a lot more about this stuff than you let on. Stop playing possum.
Well, I have been affected by a little bit of streetball, and I do know how to play a little possum, and I've been a fool. I You know, I do know my brother was a pool shark, and he did for a couple of times I served as a bagman. No, I'm not ignorant of politics. I would say that. My focus is religion. And I did aspire to a political career, so I do follow politics very closely. I'm getting my son to read the papers. I told him, if you're going to be interested in public life, you have to read at least 3 or 4 newspapers a day. There's no getting around it. And
you have to do that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that you and I can have a training class to train young people that want to be in public life, whether they want to be political, religious, how to speak. I mean, there's some essential things that you have to do. And one of the things I'm advocating to anybody that's in this audience that want to help us, you got to read the papers every day.
But I remember the lovely Imam Waqtuddin Muhammad reminding us, and I'm sure you, there's nothing that he ran down that you missed. He acknowledged one of Malcolm's strong points. And he talked about how Malcolm kept us current and informed on current events. And he pointed out that, hey, many of us don't really do that anymore. And that's really when I picked up my game, start being more concerned about current events. Even when I was in politics, my focus was just on doing my thing within the arena to project good government coming from a Muslim. I was not really on top of the overall political panorama. I understood the game, but I was not always factually current in terms of what was going on. Secondly, I wanted to be able to be quite honest to defend the legacy of President Barack Hussein Obama. And so that compelled me to really know what I'm talking about. And I do a lot of reading now of not just newspapers, but significant periodicals as well.
I think we have to, this is the weakness. I'm going to close. We have about a minute or so. I was with a Muslim from another community. He visited one of our largest masajids. And I won't name the region that it's in. And he said to me, Imam Alfred, you all have picked up all the worst aspects of, quote, end quote, black Sunniism. That is, that we have not kept up with world affairs, local affairs, we're not involved. People don't even know where to find us. And all those kinds of things, what I call what one person called urban Sufism. I'm willing to work with you and others to develop a class of young people that, and others that want to have a leadership class. I think we need to go back into community leadership. We need to know how to, the nuts and bolts of how to walk in a neighborhood and canvas as the civil rights people have done in our nation. We got to get back to that. We got to get back to knocking on doors, offering our material. You know, in New York right now, the only group that's only two groups that are really propagating their views are the Jehovah's Witnesses. They have doubled up, and the Mormons. African American Muslims are missing in action. Even the Mawthan Nation of Islam, under the leadership of the Minister Louis Farrakhan, is missing in action. They only show up when Brother Minister Farrakhan comes to town or is going to be in the area. It just seems to me that there's a great vacuum. And one of the biggest selling publications in the African American community is a magazine called Feds. Finally, Every Dimension of the Streets.
Well, let me go ahead. I'm sorry, Brother Mim.
I wanted to talk about that terrible state and how we have to invite young people. And I'm still happy to see Cleve Sellers' son, Bakari Sellers, front and center.
A Morehouse man.
I'm prejudiced toward Morehouse. Y'all have to hold me down. Now I have a son who's going to be attending Morehouse, so I'm going to become an adopted Morehouse guy. All right, so enough of that. I want you to comment on this political and social vacuum. And I think
that's a problem. I'm in an area now. It's African Americans. Most of us, I didn't have this problem, brother, ma'am, but the big power boys, they have not trained any successors. So when they pass away from the scene, many of them been in public office, public power around Alabama for 3-4 decades, some all the way back to the 60s. They haven't trained any successors. But we got to educate everybody, not just young people. Everybody around the globe. I'll give you an example. The State Department brought some visiting Muslims. They came to Selma to check out the history. They were from Africa, but the eastern part of Africa. And I know how people feel when they come to Bilal's Masjid. They think that they going to get something of inferior quality. So we were sitting up front. One brother told me he was from Uganda. Another one said he was from Zanzibar. And I hit him. I said, did you know that the president of these United States, Barack Hussein Obama, grandfather became Muslims when visiting a country in East Africa? He started smiling. He didn't know that. But it melted the ice. And when we got to the former Juma, there was a lot more respect for the possibility that the Kuba would contain some sense. So not only, but sadly, do we have to educate our young people here and others and everybody across the American demographic panorama, but we also have to educate people from other parts of the world. Now, I had a much easier time bringing some parity in the relationship with these East African brothers than I had with some of these Middle Easterners. Know-it-all, God-like creatures coming in our ranks.
Yeah, well, I have to say that many of them have come here with the attitude. This is what Imam Muhammad said. I'm quoting him. He said, they said, well, the white man used them. The Jews used them. Why should we use them? And that's the attitude of the immigrant Muslims. And I ain't going to say for the exception. I'm going to let Imam Muhammad's word stand. I'm not going to argue with the decision of a superior court judge. I'm not going to argue with that. He said that. So I think people should soak that in.
Let
the exception rule the rule.
It's
very
rare
if I find one that is, has anything other than that attitude.
Well, brother, ma'am, I'm going to tell you, so you quoted the ma'am, but the longer I live, I see things that, and I'm sure you do too, that the ma'am told us decades ago, 2-3 decades ago, in the form of the word, that actually concretely manifesting every day.
Yes, sir.
The man was tuned into something. How could this man 25 years earlier be giving us information that's panning out big time today? So go ahead.
The law was guiding him. There's no way in the world. The man said there comes a time. Well, Allah will let man follow on his own, and then he will intervene. So we know Allah directly intervened in our lives, even through the Ahmadiyya Muhammad and through Imam Muhammad directly, that Imam Muhammad there's no way
impossible for him to have done what he's done. That is, it took us away from an idea, a foreign idea of God that was even foreign and anathema to African Americans. African Americans never believed God, really, that God was all material. They believed that different. And bring us from that idea to the correct understanding of God, to the correct understanding of humanity, and to our place in humanity, and also to the fact that he then brought us to a new understanding of us as Africans and African-Americans, as Americans. There's no African-American.
No doubt about it. That's astounding.
That's astounding,
brother. That's amazing.
That's right. So we know that this had to be God. We know that others attempted it. Dr. King couldn't sell us on America. Nobody could. Imam Muhammad took a people who were the totally opposite of America, maybe anti-America, who was praying against America. And now we have a man, and again, I'm going to push this convention, we have a colonel in the United States Air Force that is at the Pentagon on his way to being a general. I'm told that he's on the general list, a short list to be a general in the United States Air Force.
Hush your mouth, brother, man. Hush your mouth.
He's going. Let me slowly tell y'all something. Y'all get your tickets. He's going to be the banquet speaker at the
Monroe
convention. The Moscow's banquet speaker. That last year we had a man that was on the short list to be the President of the United States. I speak of none other than Andrew Carter. I'm telling y'all, get on this board. There's a new train going to victory land. I didn't mean to preach, but I'm excited.
But
they're going to have Imam Alfred Muhammad from Lynchburg, Virginia, to be the khatib. People wouldn't have given me a gamble. Now, my brother, I told y'all he was a gambler. And I don't know whether he was a gambler as much as he was a slickster, because I think he shot crooked dice. Because he won a lot. But I do know the streets. But nobody, even if they had given them odds, would say Imam Alfred Muhammad would ever be the khatib on the national scene, and I'm going to be the khatib. And I can tell you all, we have a phenomenal khutbah prepared. We're going to address the three new beings on America, on the globe. A new Islam, a new African, and a new American.
Allahu Akbar. Yes, brother, ma'am. Allahu Akbar.
This has come out of what God has done. And this ain't me. This is Allah. Nobody could have done this without Allah directing them. Not Imam Muhammad wasn't that smart. He was smart. He was not. He might have been skillful and wise. But only the wisest being over creation could have ever orchestrated this to be. This is it.
Should Allah do with what he will. No doubt about it, brother. Man.
That,
he does.
We have to understand
does what
this
he
is
will.
A fine movement. And his predictions and what he said is certain. And I like I said, I understand, you know, we that's what we got to say. We have to understand we have been blessed by Almighty God. And that's the prayers of our ancestors have been answered. So I've been asking everybody to come to the convention. Allah has inspired me to say a lot of things. I got a lot of real prepared speech ready for the people. Not going to be from the hip pocket. It's going to be from the teachers of Imam Waruddin Muhammad. And I think we're going to set us on a new course. And I tell the public, there's a new sheriff in town, and he's taking names.
Inshallah. All right, my brother. What time is it? It's about time to go, isn't it?
It is time to go. It's time to go home and make some money and go back to our lives. Thank you, brother, ma'am. I'm sorry that I got fired up and I just got carried away. So please
thank you, but we don't want to go all the way up to the ceiling today. Let's save that for Chicago.
We're going to stay right down here on the ground. Why don't you close us out with a comment and a prayer?
I didn't hear you.
Why don't you close us out with a prayer and a comment?
Ya Allah, O Allah, bless the Islamic forces in America that arose from the bosom of hard-pressed slaves and people who were tormented and oppressed. We pray that thou do bless that effort continuously. Let us be grateful beyond measure. And I say, amen. And to all our brothers and sisters, I encourage you to remember the great blessing. This is not a dua, this is a comment. To remember the great blessing that Almighty God bestowed upon us as descendants of slaves right here in America. Assalamu alaikum.